Court is now ready to hear argument in 060501, Juan Maria Villafani, M.D. versus Adela Trejo.
May it please the Court, Ms. Garza will present argument for the petitioner.
Petitioner has reserved 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Ida Cecilia Garza here on behalf of Petitioner Juan Mario Villafani. Good morning. The issue before the Court this morning is whether an appellate court has jurisdiction to review a trial court's refusal to grant a defendant's motion for sanctions and dismissal filed pursuant to Article 4590I after a plaintiff files a non-suit of his claims. In other words, what effect does a non-suit have on an erroneous denial of a motion for sanctions and dismissal once the claim has been non-suited?
What makes it erroneous? Is that what makes the denial erroneous?
The denial is erroneous because as this Court is aware, Article 4590I establishes that a plaintiff must file an expert report which sets out the applicable standard of care for each defendant, the alleged breach in that standard of care, and how the alleged breach caused plaintiff's injuries. In this particular case, the expert report filed by the plaintiffs did not meet those requirements. The requirements were not met, and it was an error for the trial court not to dismiss this case with prejudice. The legislature mandated that if plaintiffs do not comply with this rigid expert report requirement, then the trial court must grant a dismissal with prejudice and must enter an order that awards defendant
Wasn't there an extension of time here to find?
In this case, no, Your Honor. And basically under 4590I, there were two options for an extension of time. Neither was requested in this case. Basically, the intent of the legislature...
If the non-suit had occurred before the trial court ruled on the motion to dismiss, do you think you could appeal then?
If the non-suit had occurred before a ruling had been made, then it would have no effect on the pending motion for sanctions. And yes, the court would have power to hear that motion. If the court refused, then yes, there would be...
So whether the court had already ruled on the motion is irrelevant in your view. You get to appeal it one way or the other.
In my view, yes, I believe so. And because of the fact that Article 4590I had a specific legislative intent, the problem that the legislature was trying to address was the repetitive filing of frivolous medical malpractice lawsuits. And in order to curtail the frivolous filing, they set out these requirements, and they had mandatory sanctions. They had a dismissal with prejudice. They had an award of attorney's fees. And a plaintiff cannot circumvent that statutory scheme by filing a frivolous lawsuit, getting past the trial court, and then all of a sudden, as in this case, within 3 weeks of the denial of the motion for sanction dismissal, plaintiffs filed a notice of non-suit, which I believe supports the argument that this was a frivolous case. And because it was a frivolous case, defendant Villafani was entitled to a dismissal with prejudice, and he was entitled to an award of attorney's fees.
Now, what happens if you were able to appeal and the Court of Appeals upheld the affidavit? What happens then? You're left with a non-suited case. The case is just, what happens? I'm not sure I would understand it if you lost your appeal.
Okay, well, in other words, if the trial court denies our motion, holds it as an adequate report.
Right.
We go up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirms it, saying it's an adequate report.
Right.
We always have you to come to, and you can decide whether. If it's an adequate report, then obviously the defendant was incorrect, and this court has felt that it has merit to continue. That was the whole point.
So the non-suit without prejudice is still good. So there's no case, but the plaintiff is free to refile.
Exactly. And see, that's the point here is...
The defendant does not recover attorney's fees and costs.
Right. If it is determined ultimately by all the appellate courts that it is an adequate expert report, which we don't feel is the case here...
Or by the final appellate court, by all the appellate courts.
Exactly. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Basically, what this court did in 2001 in Palacios was said that the purpose of this expert report was to determine whether the plaintiff's medical negligence cause of action had merit to continue. This isn't the purpose of the expert report is to determine merit. This motion for sanctions and dismissal is a motion based on the merits of the case. So a non-suit
If this had been a different case, what if this had been a motion for sanctions for discovery abuse? that you had filed, not based on the expert report, but based on some other matter. And the trial court, and then after you file your motion for sanctions, the plaintiff non-suits. Isn't there case law that says the trial court still can consider that motion for sanctions and that there can be an appeal from the trial court's ruling?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's different about this case than that?
The difference, and I'm not sure I understand your question, but the difference in this case...
In other words, this is a case where you filed a motion for sanctions. Trial court later, the plaintiff later files a non-suit and the trial court non-suits. Why wouldn't you have an appeal, just as you would if sanctions were pending when...
I believe you would have an appeal.
When the non-suit was filed.
I believe you would have an appeal. I believe that a motion for dismissal as a motion, a Rule 13 motion for sanctions, it's a claim. It's a claim for relief. It's a claim for relief for a dismissal with prejudice. It's a claim for attorney's fees. And even more importantly, is it statutorily mandated? The whole purpose of Article 4590I was to deter frivolous lawsuits. Now, if a plaintiff can file a report, any report, and the trial court deems it's adequate, even though it's not, and then realizes, all right, I'm not going to go forward. I'm going to go ahead and non-suit my claims with the ability to refile later. It's basically trying to circumvent what those – there's no deterrence is what I was trying to say. There's no deterrence effect. If the trial court – if the appellate court is allowing plaintiffs to go ahead, file this report, it's not adequate, the trial court lets it go because, let's face it, this is the Rio Grande Valley, and it is rare, if not – if it's a rare occurrence that an expert report is deemed to be inadequate and a case is dismissed. And that rarely happens down there. So plaintiffs know this. That's why they file their cases down there.
Why is that? I've noticed that, too. It's I'm sure these people can read. And what's why is it that in one part of the state there's a different standard applied to expert reports?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I mean, I think it's just they basically – really want to afford every opportunity they can to a plaintiff. And, in fact, we have judges in Hidalgo County who, during a hearing on a motion for sanctions dismissal, say they disagree with the legislature. They're making it hard, and I'm not going to agree with this. I don't like this expert report requirement. So this is what we're dealing with.
That would happen here?
Excuse me?
Is that what happened here?
That did not happen in this case, no. That did not happen in this court.
Let me ask you, if there were a motion for summary judgment by the defendant on the ground that there was no competent expert testimony that had been adduced so far, and therefore the plaintiff was not going to be able to get to the jury. And that motion were denied, and then there was a non-suit. Would the defendant be allowed to appeal the denial of the summary judgment motion?
I feel that the defendant should be allowed to appeal that.
We have a pretty strong rule that you can't appeal.
Right, exactly.
So what's the difference? It seems like at least the summary judgment motion is on the merits, whereas the motion to dismiss for want of a expert report is largely a procedural it's certainly a preliminary sort of thing.
Well, I think you're right, and I think the fact that it is a preliminary procedural thing that Article 4590I says you have to do. They put these hoops up there for the plaintiffs to grow through, and they need to do it. And the fact that they don't do it and they're not able to do it shows the frivolous nature of the lawsuit. I think that's what the difference is this is a statutorily mandated dismissal with prejudice.
But also, a rule on the merits in a summary judgment context doesn't involve, generally doesn't, a denial would involve assessment of attorney's fees, right?
Generally, no, it would not.
Sanctions. So, I mean, that's what I'm trying to key in on here. There's statutorily you're entitled to your fees, and you've moved for sanctions and sought the fees. So it seems to me that's a pending claim for relief.
It is. It is a pending claim for relief, and it is a claim. It's an affirmative claim for relief. It is completely dependent on it's completely independent from plaintiff's cause of action. This is a cause of... I guess you could say a type of cause of action that is given to a defendant in a medical negligence case where the defendant can ask the trial court, give me my attorney's fees, give me a dismissal with prejudice, because that's what the statute has mandated to, in a case where the expert report is inadequate. Now, the another effect of a non-suit is to place the plaintiff and the defendant in the same posture they were prior to the filing of a lawsuit. In this case, in a medical negligence case, that does not happen. Basically, the defendant Viafani has incurred attorney's fees. He has wasted several months, I believe it was nearly 10 months, before this hearing, before plaintiff's non-suit. So because of the fact that the statute requires, as a deterrence, plaintiffs need to give the defendant his attorney's fees, he's not in the same posture that he was before the lawsuit was filed. Another problem with the 13th Court of Appeals opinion is it's flawed in several aspects. The 13th Court of Appeals opinion conflicts with its own prior precedent. There was a case, Del Villar versus Garcia, which we appealed a denial of a dismissal after a non-suit, and we were told by the 13th Court of Appeals, no, there are still pending motions. We have no jurisdiction. The only pending motions were other motions for sanctions and dismissal, which had been non-suited. No jurisdiction. Fine. The Court of Appeals also says that writ of mandamus is not available under 4590I to determine the adequacy of an expert report because an adequate appeal by remedy exists. They did that back in March of 2004 in In Re Maldonado. They did that recently last month in In Re Clinica Santa Maria. And then when we get a non-suit, because they're telling us we have an adequate remedy by appeal, we take that final appealable order and we take it up to 13th Court of Appeals and they tell us, no, you don't have jurisdiction. So it's conflicting. The opinions that are issued out of that court are conflicting and we're left with absolutely no remedy. Additionally, it doesn't distinguish, another major flaw in the 13th Court of Appeals is it doesn't distinguish between claimants. It's just a blanket, we have no jurisdiction, non-suit vitiates all prior interlocutory orders, that's it. In this particular case, plaintiffs did have the right to refile within the statute of limitations period. They didn't, and that's not a problem. However, there are cases, and another one which is currently pending before this court in Barrera versus Rico, where the alleged negligence occurred at birth. So you have 20 years where a plaintiff can file, give us an inadequate expert report, the trial court's going to say it's adequate, non-suit, refile. It's a cycle that'll never end in a case like that. That's not the case currently before this court. However, a blanket rule that we have no jurisdiction, it affects a case like that. Basically, what the 13th Court of Appeals is doing is they're encouraging plaintiff's attorneys to find ways to skirt the legislative mandates. They're telling them, we agree with you, that's fine. Go ahead and do whatever you have to do, non-suit whenever you have to, and that's all right, because we're going to say that there's no jurisdiction, and defendants will have absolutely no adequate remedy. They'll have no way to appeal, and they won't be able to get their statutorily mandated award that was contemplated by the legislature.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Brzezinski will present argument for the respondent.
How does an appellate court have jurisdiction on a non-suit?
How does an appellate court have jurisdiction on a non-suit? Well, first of all, under the current law, it's a moot issue because if a motion to dismiss for inadequate report is denied currently, it goes up on appeal interlocutorily. So I would submit that this issue is a non-issue because this scenario doesn't exist anymore. I would also point out initially that as far as this particular suit goes, the statute of limitations ran on June 14th of 2004. The statute had actually run before the order of non-suit was entered. So plaintiff, in spite of the non-suit being characterized as one without prejudice to refiling, the statute of limitations had actually already gone by the boards.
But it might make a difference to the defendant whether the case was dismissed because it was frivolous or not, or dismissed just because the plaintiff's decided not to go forward. Might make a difference to how I felt about my record if I was the doctor, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've got 3 points that I'd like to make this morning. The first one is that the petitioner has admitted that there was no pending claim at the time of this non-suit. Petitioner concedes on page 1 of his reply brief, which was filed in January 10th of this year, that, quote, there is absolutely no doubt that petitioner's motion for sanctions and dismissal was no longer pending at the time of the non-suit. Rule 162 expressly states that a dismissal under this rule shall have no effect on any motion for sanctions, attorney's fees, or other costs pending at the time of dismissal.
Well, but, I mean, pending meaning it had already been ruled on.
Yes, ma'am.
So that doesn't really answer the question. I mean, my understanding is the fact that it's been ruled on, it's still alive in the case. It's just that it's sort of an arbitrary line to say if it's not been ruled on that you can appeal it, but if it has been, you can't.
Well, and I think there are other reasons to show that this does not fit into the category of claims that survive a non-suit, and I'll get to that in just one moment. But I do think it is important. In BHP versus Millard, which is a 1990 Supreme Court case, this court confirmed that the right to non-suit is absolute unless there is a pending claim. The Bennett case...
But the legislature could change that.
Yes.
And they did in 1301P, right?
They did that in Chapter 74, yes.
Well, before that, 4590I, wasn't there same provision in the event of a conflict?
I'm sorry, with regard to the right to...
In conflict in this section and another law, including a rule of procedure, this section controls to the extent of the conflict?
Yes, sir.
So, I mean, it doesn't really matter what we've said when you can non-suit if they say otherwise, does it?
That is true, sir. And I think the important thing about the Bennett case, which was alluded to earlier by one of the other justices, is that in the Bennett case, the court refused to sign an order of non-suit because there were sanctions pending. So that's different from this case in that there was a pending motion. In this case, the court has already ruled on the motion to dismiss. And
denied sanctions, which if that's the reason it denied sanctions because it thought the affidavit was fine. But if that was wrong, then the motion has to be reconsidered by the trial court, doesn't it?
Well, I would...
Sanctions mandatory.
Your Honor,
I would
submit that the way the law existed under 4590I, petitioner had no further right. I would quote In re Schneider, 134 Southwest 2nd at 869. The legislature expressly chose to apply the amendment prospectively, giving the right to an interlocutory appeal. Had the legislature intended to provide interlocutory review of the denial of motions to dismiss under the former article, it could have done so. It did not. I would also point out that petitioner's motion to dismiss was not a judgment on the merits.
But would you answer my question that I posed to counsel earlier? If there's a motion for sanctions for discovery abuse, let's say it's in that context, and after that motion for sanctions is filed, the plaintiff non-suits the case, does that motion for sanctions survive or not?
I think under the Bennett case, and particularly if the trial court refuses to sign the order of non-suit, then yes, it does survive. Bennett is analogous because it was sanctions directed to the attorney for the attorney's conduct. And I think in your example, Mr. Chief Justice, yes, it would probably survive.
So why is this different? It's a motion for sanctions that is grounded in the statute that says we get attorney's fees for this inadequate report.
It's a motion for sanctions related to directly tied to the underlying claim. And again, in the Millard case, the court says that a claim for affirmative relief, in other words, a claim that survives a non-suit, must allege a cause of action independent of the plaintiff's claim on which the claimant could recover compensation or relief, even if the plaintiff abandons or is unable to establish his cause of action.
But would that fit on a discovery abuse type sanction? It's not an independent cause of action. It's just complaining about your opponent's conduct.
Well, and I think the Bennett case gives the court the right under those circumstances where it's attorney conduct to refuse to sign the non-suit. This is not attorney conduct. This is a consideration of a preliminary matter. I think, as Justice Heck indicated, a procedural matter, not an evidentiary one.
Why did signing the non-suit order have any effect? I thought plaintiffs had an absolute right to just notice of a non-suit. There's no order involved. Why does that matter?
They do, Justice Green. The non-suit is effective upon the notice. The appellate guidelines, the appellate deadlines, excuse me, begin to run when the order is signed.
Or the notice is filed.
That could be true. My recollection of the case is kind of distinguished the two. I know there's probably some confusion there.
Sometimes trial courts never sign orders of non-suit because they know it's effective. The non-suit's effective on filing.
That is true. Obviously, it was the practice of our office at the time of this case, at least, to simply file a notice of non-suit, and the order of non-suit is actually tendered to the court by petitioner.
So it sounds like, to overgeneralize your position, it's, you know, defendants won. We non-suited and went away. Sounds like you're acknowledging that the statute of limitations has run and the case cannot be brought again legitimately. So the case should be over. It's done. Why do we have to keep fighting over this? There's no longer any jurisdiction or reason to appeal it. Defendants are saying that the legislature said cases against doctors and health care providers in which there's no adequate expert report to base the case on, entitles the other side, the healthcare provider or doctor, to get their attorney's fees and costs. And they're saying that that survives even a non-suit, and that they have an appellate, a right to go to appeals courts to get a determination that the case's expert report entitles them to those fees and costs. Don't we have to look at the legislative intent and particularly the wording of the statute to see if they intended that to survive 162? We can't just conclude that Rule 162 automatically ends the issue. We've got to look at what the legislature intended, don't we?
I think so, Justice Wainwright, and I think you need to look at the law interpreting the cases. And first of all, I'm not aware of any case in this state that gave defendants under 4590I the right to appeal the denial of a motion to dismiss.
So you're saying this is a case of first impression?
I would believe so, yes.
Which means we, again, look at the words the legislature used and their intent and figure out what they meant.
That's correct, and I think you need to look at the case law as well. Petitioner would have you hold that the report requirement under the old Article 4590I was a judgment on the merits, that a ruling on the motion to dismiss would equate to a judgment on the merits. And obviously, to do so avoids the extinguishment of the suit. A trial court's...
It acts as a judgment on the merits in many ways. I mean, it's a dismissal with prejudice, and it's based on the failure to meet elements of proof, substantively.
Well, I would argue that if granted, a motion to dismiss really terminates the case on a procedural ground, not an evidentiary.
It's sort of a hybrid, though, isn't it? It's not like you're dismissing it because you didn't pay your filing fee or some reason like that. It's because the legislature has said you have to make some prima facie showing of your case, and if you fail to do that, then it is a bit of a merits determination, isn't it?
I can see, Justice O'Neill, what you're saying, that it's somewhere in between a full-blown evidentiary determination on the merits. And
it's certainly merits-related.
Well, and I think we need to look at the Palacios holding is instructive. Petitioner would interpret Palacios to say that there's a quote from Palacios in petitioner's brief that says that the purpose of the report requirement under Article 4590I is to provide a basis for the trial court to conclude that the claims have merit. And I think petitioner would have you isolate that word merit to say, okay, this is a determination on the merits of the case. If you read further in Palacios at page 879, the court states, to avoid dismissal, a plaintiff need not present evidence in the report as if it were actually litigating the merits. And that opinion goes on to say the report can be informal in that the information in the report does not have to meet the same requirements as evidence offered in a summary judgment hearing or trial.
But it is clearly by the rule itself, I mean, it's merit-based. You'd have to admit it's not purely procedural.
But petitioner wants you to bootstrap it essentially into a summary judgment ruling.
There are a lot of reasons to dismiss the lawsuit. It didn't have to be because you didn't find an expert. It could be for other reasons. You can think of a laundry list of them. Counsel wasn't ready. Plaintiff decided not to pursue a cause of action. What have you. I mean, there's. So I understand your argument.
Well, and Your Honor, it's not unusual in a medical malpractice context to have the case reviewed, have an expert tell you the case has merit against defendants X, Y, and Z. You get into the case and actually start developing the evidence, conducting discovery, and you realize, you know what, defendant X shouldn't be in this suit. And you make the determination to non-suit them. I think the effect of what petitioner is arguing would actually discourage plaintiffs, or at least under 4590I, it would have discouraged plaintiffs from willingly non-suiting defendants. And that, to me, doesn't make any sense. But you are correct. There are many different reasons why you would you may end up having to non-suit a defendant. And again, although there is some element of a merit-based decision, this is not an affidavit. There is no evidence actually submitted at the hearing on the report. There are no records attached to the report. The report is by an individual who has no factual connection to the underlying case. It can have hearsay in it. It really is very, very distinct from summary judgment evidence, which obviously is a ruling on the merits that survives a non-suit. But it's very distinct from that. It's very distinct from trial evidence. And so I think it's erroneous to equate it to a decision on the merits that ought to survive the non-suit. And again, I think that distinguished from Bennett and some of the other cases, there was nothing pending at the time this non-suit was, the order was entered. The motion had been heard. It had been denied. Petitioner had the opportunity to request rehearing, to file a motion for summary judgment, to file for writ of mandamus. There are many actions that could have been taken which clearly would have survived the non-suit. None of those occurred. 3 months went by, and then petitioner submitted the order of non-suit, and when it was signed, then the appeal was filed. So I think that this is clearly an instance where the non-suit under the Blackmun case and some of the other cases, the non-suit terminated petitioner's right to complain about this.
So do you think this case, in which there was an expert report filed, is distinguishable from this situation, where a lawsuit is filed against a healthcare provider, no expert report is ever served, and then there's a motion to dismiss after 120 days, and before that is, well, the judge then denies that, however, and then there's a non-suit. Do you think there should be jurisdiction to review that on appeal?
Yeah, I think under the way the law existed in 2004, no.
Clearly no merit because no expert report was filed. You think still the non-suit ends the discussion entirely?
It does, Your Honor, and if the plaintiff's statute has not run and the plaintiff elects to refile, then obviously the defendant will refile the motion to dismiss. And either the plaintiff has obtained an expert report and the matter can be heard and you go down the same trail. But I think under the way the law, and again, as the In re Schneider case said, that's the way the law was at that time.
Does that have the effect of, in the serial filing case that we're talking about, just accumulating the fees and expenses that the legislature said healthcare providers should not have to pay for inadequate or failure to file expert reports?
It would, and I think the
it
remedy...
It could happen that way under the scenario we're talking about, right?
It would, Your Honor, and I think the remedy that would survive non-suit in that case very likely would be a motion for sanctions directly against the lawyer, not sanctions related to the report, but sanctions for inexcusable conduct, just like in the Bennett case where the plaintiffs filed a number of lawsuits at the same time and then tried to consolidate them all into the court that they felt was most helpful to them. Those sanctions were directly against the attorney. And in that case, Judge Bennett refused to sign the order of non-suit. And under those circumstances, the court said that survived the filing of the notice of non-suit by the plaintiffs. I think appealing a matter that has been non-suited has the same effect on the part of the defendants, on the part of the petitioner. We've worked on this appeal for 3 years, and there have been costs certainly racked up on a case that the 13th Court of Appeals said they had no jurisdiction to consider.
Well, you could have dismissed with prejudice.
I could have, Your Honor. The effect was exactly the same in this case. Because the statute
was eventually. It wasn't at the time.
The statute had actually run at the time the non-suit, the order was signed. We had no ability to refile the case.
So why didn't you do it with prejudice and avoid 3 years of appeal?
I think, Your Honor, I think that the appeal probably would have gone forward regardless. Only petitioner can answer that, but I think the appeal would have gone forward regardless. The statute had run. Why we didn't do it that way, I guess it's because I instruct my legal assistants to always file a non-suit without prejudice. Simple matter of that. I have nothing further.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Few points to reply. I want to make it perfectly clear because I feel as respondent still doesn't quite understand our argument. We're not saying that plaintiff had no right to non-suit. We're not saying that the trial court erred in granting the non-suit. What we're saying is the effect of that non-suit made a prior order for denying our sanctions, our motion for sanctions and dismissal, which was an interlocutory order, made that order final and appealable. According to
does that happen when the order is signed or when the non-suit is taken?
Yes, no. It's the non-suit takes effect at when the plaintiff files his notice of non-suit. However, the appellate deadlines and timetables begin to run when the order granting the non-suit is signed.
And if an order is never signed by the trial judge granting the non-suit?
Deadlines don't start.
Not your case.
That's why we submit an order.
Deadlines never start, did you say?
Well, I misspoke. I apologize. If a trial court refuses to enter an order, I would assume that there are several ways you can get it. There are mandamus trying to get the court to enter an order, to finally get that order signed, so that the appellate deadlines can start to run. So basically, it is not. We're not saying that they shouldn't have filed their notice, their non-suit. We're not saying they can't. We're just saying that the effect of that notice basically just made our interlocutory order, which under Article 4590I was not appealable. It made it a final appealable order. And yes, there was some questions about whether Justice O'Neill brought up whether this is a substantive requirement or procedural requirement. The expert report requirement is a procedural requirement with substantive issues. Palacio says it's a determination to see whether the case has merit to continue, to go forward. The report has to be written by a qualified expert. It has to have opinions based for the standard of care, the breach, and the causation required in all medical negligence cases. It is a report on the merits of the case. Does this case have the merit to go forward? It is not simply a procedural motion. It is not simply a procedural issue. It's based on the substance of the report. Respondent mentioned that the current state of law says that a non-suit vitiates it, it's over, jurisdiction, it's done. The Hyundai versus Alvarado case says that a non-suit may have the effect of vitiating. It does not say shall, it does not say it always does, it says it may. And it specifically accepts where it was based on merits. It's our position that, yes, although this is a procedural requirement, it's a procedural requirement that includes substantive issues. It includes the merits.
Let's say, hypothetically, there's a motion to dismiss, trial court denies it, the case goes all the way to trial, defendants lose at trial, there's a final judgment, you appeal it. Can you appeal that the denial of the motion to dismiss? And if you win that, can you go back and get attorney's fees and costs?
I would say that you can.
Even though you lost at trial?
I would say that you can, because the basis of the 120-day requirement, back then 180-day requirement, was that you have to show, you have to meet these elements. And if that expert report was inadequate, the trial court let it go forward. It eventually went to trial, and in the unfortunate case that plaintiff would prevail in that case, but the report was obviously inadequate, then that was a procedural issue and a substantive issue that should have been dealt with in the beginning. And I believe that a defendant has a right to appeal that issue even after a judgment against him. Finally, I believe that Justice O'Neill also brought up an interesting point about why it's an arbitrary rule, why it can go forward as to whether it's pending, whether it has been ruled on, or it has not been ruled on. That's the problem that the decision and then the current state of the law is the 13th Court of Appeals, I believe the 4th Court of Appeals is doing the same thing, is it's creating an arbitrary rule as to what you can and can't appeal. And I just strongly argue to this court that the legislature mandated this. This is a dismissal with prejudice. It's an award of attorney's fees. We're trying to stop frivolous lawsuits. We're trying to deter plaintiff's attorneys from continually filing these frivolous lawsuits. And if we're not enforcing, the trial court is not enforcing what's mandated, which has the word shall in it, it's not having that effect. Also, respondent brought up the fact that this would discourage, being able to appeal would discourage a plaintiff from willingly non-suit any cause of action with regardless of the reason. I don't think so, because if it was a claim that had merit and it was not a frivolous lawsuit and they had their expert report that satisfied all the elements, I don't think there'd be an issue to appeal. So it's not discouraging. If this is a case with merit, if it's not a frivolous case, it shouldn't discourage anybody from filing a non-suit. The problem is, in a case like this where it's a frivolous, as to this defendant, the requirements were not met, this case should have not gone forward and it should have been dismissed with prejudice. So no, I don't think that allowing an appeal from an order of non-suit would in any way discourage a plaintiff from making his trial strategy decisions and deciding who to non-suit and who not. Basically, I just would conclude with asking this court to correct the flawed interpretation of the 13th Court of Appeals and hold that an appellate court does have jurisdiction over an erroneous denial, a failure of a trial court to grant a motion to dismissal, which so obviously should be granted. Just because a plaintiff non-suits their claim does not rob an appellate court of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Garza. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
Thank you.
Rise.